Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our show today. In this podcast, we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Mr. Tom Kirkham. He is the CEO and co-founder of a major cyber tech company called Iron Tech Security. Tom, thank you for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
Yeah, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you for your time. Now, we looked up your bio. We didn't do a background check or anything. Don't worry about that. And we did some snooping on Google and everything. And you seem to have a very deep and rich background in technology and cybersecurity. Can you tell us about the highlights of your career and how that led you to starting the company that you have today?
Sure. Well, I've been in technology all my life. Years ago, I was a founder and a principal in a software company that did retail management software that basically more or less didn't survive the dot-com bust. So when that happened, I decided I wanted to get into IT management. So this was a little over 20 years ago. And then as time went on, I saw that security was becoming more and more professional, you know, the hacking, the bad guys. And it was evolving to a much higher level than what it was in the old days when you had Michelangelo virus and these things that were just done by hackers that did it more or less for bragging rights. You know, it turned into an entire industry in and of itself. And since we were providing IT management to small to medium-sized businesses, it just naturally grew, that cybersecurity element grew out of that. And we established it as a separate division. And we make security job one, which a lot of managed IT companies don't approach it from that angle. You know, they still are, they're still serving their clients with, you know, productivity and efficiency gains, because managed IT is about the bottom line, whereas cybersecurity defense is more of a strategic and a leadership decision that basically has to do with the survival of the company itself, you know, not to mention loss of productivity and having to pay ransoms and all these different things. And so we evolved into doing that, and about 7 years ago, the FBI came into the office, and the agent said, I'm Agent So-and-so with the FBI. I'm looking for Tom Kirkham. I said, that's me. And he goes, well, you're in trouble, but not with us. And he proceeded to tell me that I was on an ISIS kill list, named, obviously, because he knew who to look for. And the reason I was on that list, if you remember back that particular year, there were a lot of, there were like five or six different ISIS kill lists that were published. And they were mostly military, politicians, law enforcement, New York metro area, and other things. But there was one list that was people all over the nation. And it was the result of a data breach. And the objective of ISIS was just to create more chaos and tie up law enforcement and all of that. But they actually went around. There's several thousand on the list. And they notified everybody that they were on an ISIS kill list. So that made it really personal. And that's something that you can't ever think that you might be targeted. I mean, all you have to do is look at Salman Rushdie, who was attacked
right
before speaking engagement in New York. And so it's kind of a lifetime deal. And right now, you know, ISIS has been beaten back pretty good, but we just don't know about the future. But that really made it personal for me.
Right. Are you safe now? I mean, do you have to have, like, a protective service with you? Or
no. And I never really did do that. They supposedly upped the police patrols in the area, but I really never saw any of that. You know, the biggest threat to me is going to be a lone wolf. And, you know, it's probably going to be somebody already in the United States, probably an American citizen, that is wanting to score points with ISIS and go do training. You know, they're sympathetic to their cause. And right now, with them beat back so much, I just don't think it's that worrisome right now. If I was really worried about it, I wouldn't publicize that. But I mentioned it in the book. I've been talking about it for a couple of years now. And, you know, someday I may have to do that. But hopefully that's a very expensive proposition to have security detail.
Well, please continue to be safe. Now, tell us more about your company, Iron Tech Security, and how did you get that name?
Gosh, that's a really good question. Well, we're nationwide, or really North American, what's known in the business as a managed security services provider. So if you're familiar with managed IT services, those are called MSPs. When your specialty is security, that's where the managed security services provider comes in. And there's a whole lot fewer of us. These, and most of them, as far as I know, all of them are usually national or international in scope. And the name came about as an internally brand on our services that we're calling Iron Tech. And then we just added the security part to it. And that's kind of how the whole name came about. And, you know, that's our primary driving force. You know, anytime we take on a new client, all clients of both divisions are Iron Tech security clients. Some clients also get managed IT services. So, you know, when we're dealing with a law firm in Hawaii or New York or whatever, they may have their own IT provider, but they're using us for security.
Okay. Because I noticed that you also have another company called Kirkwood IT, I believe.
Kirkham.IT.
Kirkham.IT. Now, how is that different from Iron Tech?
That is the managed services provider division.
Gotcha. Okay. Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, as we
go on, we're going to co-brand, I think, and start moving towards a single division. But the important thing to remember is security is job one for us. You know, we require our clients, regardless of what they're hiring us to do, to put in security best practices.
Okay, excellent. Now, how long have you been in business?
About 20-something years, 21, 22 years.
Okay. Congratulations. It's a long time. Nope. Especially, you know, having survived COVID, that's, you know, really hats off right there, too. Also, you know, when so many other businesses have failed, congratulations on that.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, the cybersecurity business is growing 20 to 30% a year, and it really allowed us to change our marketing strategy. And we went to I was doing some speaking in public, you know, trying to educate people on cybersecurity, but it allowed us to do it all virtually with Zoom.
Oh, cool. Okay. Now, you mentioned you have a national footprint all over, you know, the United States. What geographic region do you find most of your business in, or is it kind of like scattered and dispersed? And on top of that, you have a global also.
Yeah, we haven't branched outside of North America yet. But as far as, you know, it's mostly the United States by far, but it's really from the smallest islands of Hawaii to Brooklyn to, you know, Florida, Washington State. I think we might have an installation or two in Alaska. It's really what we're finding in especially in the niches that we go into, we really like to do professional service firms like engineering, attorneys, court systems, accounting, financial, and it has a lot to do with the associations, you know, the bar associations, the accounting societies, and things like that. And those that really do a good job getting their members better educated are the ones where we end up with a lot of installations, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. Now, tell us about the products and services that you have to offer. I'm at your website right now. It seems like you're pretty well entrenched in, I guess, three different areas of security, the cybersecurity in general, training, and security awareness. Can you kind of do a deep dive in all three, or if I'm missing something, can you include that as well too?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. So let me see if I can break this down for you. We provide the actual defense, and things like security training and security awareness, educational content, those are just parts of the puzzle. So when we engage with a new client, we onboard a new client, we certainly recommend that they get continuous cybersecurity training for everyone in the organization. They've already gotten to us through educational means, more than likely. But then we get down to business, and we said, okay, we're a best-of-breed managed security services provider. That means all of our defensive controls, and by defensive controls, I'm talking administrative controls, technical controls, and frequently physical controls. So when you look at those three types of controls, administrative control is something as simple as password policies, complexity requirements. Another administrative is when is the office locked and unlocked, and who has the keys to the office, who has the keys to the server room, who has the key to the server itself. Those are all administrative, and with the locks, they become technical or physical controls. But then you've got the other side of what are we actually installing on the network to detect intrusions, prevent intrusions, and to block all of this malicious, email attachments and block hackers coming in through firewalls and all of this. And we provide best-of-breed technical controls that do those things. For example, we don't offer any sort of antivirus. We install best-of-breed what's known in the business as an EDR, or in our case, it's actually a managed EDR. It's an endpoint detect and respond system that is far and away more advanced than an antivirus. You know, antivirus technology is, what, almost 40-year-old technology. And the modern EDR systems are in a whole different class. They use artificial intelligence, and they actually look at the behavior of everything that's going on the computer, the behavior of the user, and can predict and alert InfoSec specialists that an attack is imminent or something suspicious. So it detects these anomalies for further investigation.
Excellent. So who is your typical customer like? Are you trying to target the SMBs, the federal government, the Fortune 500, or is it kind of a conglomeration of all three of them?
Well, we specialize in small to medium-sized firms. Like I said, professional service firms are our bread and butter. We do a little bit in the critical infrastructure with water utilities. And they are typically the one that's more likely to outsource this type of service, these types of services. They're not going to have an IT staff, and even if they have an IT staff, they're not going to have security specialists, InfoSec specialists, because there's a big difference between the two skill sets, and those roles are totally different from the way you think of things.
Okay. Now, as you had mentioned, and there are hundreds of MSPs out there, and there are probably thousands of other cyber vendors out there, maybe, I think last count was, 2,000 or 3,000, just here in the United States, worldwide, who knows how many more. What separates your company, IronTech, from the rest of the crowd? That one thing that a customer will say, well, Tom, I'm going to come to you versus everybody else.
Well, I think it's been my experience that about 90% of the MSPs out there are not doing best-of-breed practices. Many of them are still putting antivirus on their clients' computers, and other, password policies are weak. There's every year the time it takes to crack a password in a brute force attack is decreasing more and more and more every single year. So it's not uncommon for us to go in a situation where they're using 8-character passwords, you know, for logins, you know, network logins and website logins and things like that. So what really separates us is the sheer concentration on security being job one. So, you know, it's really easy as a manager or a business owner to understand investing in IT, because we've been doing it for decades. Our whole society has. So, and it's about productivity and efficiency. If you properly invest in IT, it positively affects your P&L each and every day, because people are more productive. Work is more efficient. If you're in manufacturing, you've got to have computers to run the manufacturing facility. And so it's more of an operationals type decision. It's a real easy decision, because that's the way it's been for decades. But when it comes to security, about half the people don't even know where to begin to look for security. And security is a strategic and a leadership decision. You know, it's part of that leadership role, the president, CEO, the business owner, that they've got to realize that the very viability of their company could change in a moment's notice by a breach, especially if you're dealing with professional services companies. You know, your accountants, lawyers, and arguably every business, your reputation is everything. And if you get a data breach and client data is exposed and released to the public or whatever, or financial data or credit cards or any of those things, that can ruin a reputation and destroy a company. So cybersecurity expenditures, generally, you hope it's always a negative impact on a P&L. It's like buying business liability insurance. It's like paying the light bill. Got to have it. And, you know, once people become aware of that, it becomes just a no-brainer decision, because it's really not that expensive. Now, you mentioned the Fortune 500 companies. Well, all the Fortune 500 companies now have chief information security officers. The forward-thinking Fortune 500 companies are making IT report to the chief information security officer. We saw that happen with Booz Allen, the big global consulting firm, one of the largest, if not the largest, global consulting firm. They plug, instead of plugging cybersecurity onto IT, they reversed it and plugged IT onto cybersecurity, because they realized how important it was to the very survival of the firm. So when we started adding these new administrative and technical controls, at first we had some pushback because we couldn't get our clients to spend the arguably minimal amount of extra money to up their security game. And so a few years ago we said, okay, well, we're going to require everybody to be EDR, or they're going to have to go somewhere else, because we can't take the risk on. And we have some of our products and services that we simply require clients to take on. It's not optional. If you want to be a client of ours, you've got to have these, because they could be a threat vector to us. And that's an important distinction to make between us and an MSP or a pure play MSP. You know, if you're dealing with an MSP that doesn't require your company to use an EDR like CrowdStrike or SentinelOne, and they're still running an internet protection suite from one of the popular off-the-shelf vendors, well, then they're really not taking security seriously. Does that make sense?
Yep, excellent. Now, do you have any customer success story that you'd like to share with us, or any use cases? Obviously, without giving any names or any other confidential information.
Right, and that's actually one of our policies. We have a we have an actual administrative control on just giving out who our clients are. which because that makes them less of a target. You know, if the hackers know who our clients are and say we've got a patent attorney or a patent law firm does intellectual property, well, Chinese would target us. We would become a threat vector for that patent firm. You know, some of the things, you know, we don't require everything. You know, we don't say you've got to buy everything in our security stack and do everything we say. Everybody's level of risk is different. Every single installation has a different risk profile. So one of the things that we have is a very small law firm had just gone with us like a month earlier, and then they became a victim of a business email compromise. The BEC is what's called in the business. And what happened was the hacker had compromised his public email address. It was a Yahoo or thing like that, AOL, which is horrible practice to use those. And we had recommended that he needs to get a private, secure email. But a hacker compromised his account, and he actually sent a $15,000 invoice to a client that had the ACH information, the routing number and the bank account number on it. It got intercepted by the hacker, and the hacker changed the routing number and the bank account number, and the client accidentally sent the $15,000 to the hacker.
Ooh.
Now, we immediately got a call from the attorney and said, yeah, okay, I need private email now. You know, we've had a few other hacking instances. We shut down a surgery office. It was an oral surgeon that had a very, very wicked ransomware attack, and we finally had to shut him down. You know, no more surgeries, cancel appointments. It's that serious. And our tools held. They did not end up getting hit with a ransom demand. Their files weren't encrypted except for some marginal, non-important stuff. And we kept him from being the victim of a data breach. And they were only down for really just one full business day. We got them back up and running by Monday of the next week, but it still took a month to clean everything up. And we saved that attack. And had that office not had an EDR on there, they would have certainly been victimized because it was a particularly vicious lateral movement attack. For those in the audience that knows what that is in the cybersecurity world, you know they're really, really vicious, very difficult to stop. But it took us a long time to remediate everything. But the good news is what our specialty is preventing these attacks from happening. You know, we already have our policies and procedures. We know what the environment is. And from then on, it's just looking for anomalies and stopping the attacks. You know, it's mitigate, respond, mitigate, remediate, and respond to these, just the anomalies. Is different than being an incident response organization to where they don't have a relationship with the client and the client's been a victim of a hacking attack. That's when you bring in an incident response team to negotiate ransoms and to clean everything up. We prefer not to do that. We really don't even like to get calls from prospects that are in the midst of an attack because that creates a threat vector to us and all of our clients. You know, if we engage and start putting our tools on the network, just the engagement itself could make us a threat vector to whoever the hacker may be. There's a lot of specialties. There's a lot of specialties in cybersecurity. You know, the bad guys themselves are vertically specialized. You know, it's a multi-trillion dollar worldwide business. And so when you look at a storyline of a typical ransomware attack, the vector is typically through email. It has a malicious file attachment. Well, the ransomware attacker themselves, their specialty is carefully crafting that email, the subject, the content of the email. They use psychological manipulation techniques, social engineering, but it's really just a con job. And their objective is to get them to open up the file attachment, the Excel spreadsheet, typically, and then that calls the Windows encryption service and begins the attack. So that, forgot my train of thought here, but that's their special skill, but they are supported by many other specialists in the criminal underworld. They've probably done a software as a service for an encryption server, a whitelisted encryption service, and that is provided by specialty criminals within that the bad guy hacking industry. They probably have a help desk and a 1-800 help desk to aid victims in either obtaining Bitcoin or unencrypting the files, and that service is provided by other criminals that specialize in that. And the list goes on and on.
But isn't the whole thing not really called a ransomware as a service? I mean, on the dark web, I think cyber attackers can literally like get a full-fledged company, and they'll do everything for them. They come across
right, and then there's software kits that you can download off the dark web. It'll build your attack for you. But yes, if you look at the big hackers, I think they got $3.5 billion worldwide. It was G and Crab, which when you write it and you reverse the C and G, it actually spells C and Grab, right? And it's C and Grab the money. They grossed $3.5 billion, and there was what we believe were two individuals heading it all up, and they used a lot of different distribution methods where they had affiliates and people under them. They outsourced everything, as far as we know, help desk, encryption servers, clean email servers, and on and on and on. And even though they netted about $300 million each, the other $2.9 billion was distributed amongst all of the criminals in the whole entire enterprise, affiliate partners, and on and on and on. So what you have to know is it's done at scale. It's highly automated. They don't know and they don't care and probably never do know who you are, where you're located, whether you're in the middle of Western Texas in a real small, one-horse town, or if you're in Manhattan. They don't care. It's a numbers game. They're thinking in terms of conversion rates. How many victims are we going to get out of mailing out 100,000 emails? So when they mail out, let's say it's probably 100,000 attorneys, give or take, that are members of the New York State Bar Association. They get that list, and they're going to craft an email that will get somebody in a law office to open it up. It looks like it's from a vendor that law offices commonly use. They got a vendor that provides research or CLE courses, things like that. And they manipulate them into opening that file attachment. It'll probably say something like, if you don't pay these outstanding invoices, immediately we're shutting the service off. And someone in bookkeeping gets that. They go, well, we paid our bills. Let me see what they're sending out. So they open up the file attachment and it unleashes the attack. But let's say I've got 100,000 emails going out and only 1% of them become victims. And let's say I collect an average of $10,000 per victim. That's a $10 million payday in just one state, in just one vertical market, just law firms in one state. And then they just rinse and repeat for whoever they're talking, whatever list they have. So a lot of people, we're all caught up with, the Colonial Pipelines, the JBS, meat supply company, whatever they're called, these four and 10 and 15 and $50 million ransoms that make CNN, New York Times, and on and on and on. But in reality, it's the small businesses is where the bulk of it is. You know, the hackers that broke into Pipeline Network, that was, even though it was a targeted attack, they didn't know who they were. They just knew it was a big target. So they were dedicated to getting into that target. It's a big company. For those of you that don't know, Colonial Pipeline distributes petroleum all up and down the east coast of the United States. I just happened to be in Florida at the tail end of that, and there were still lines at the gas station. People couldn't get gas on the east coast.
Right.
Anyway, they finally got in. They let the ransomware loose and shut Colonial down. Petroleum distribution, shut the whole company down. They did not know what they had done until it made the headlines around the world on CNN or whatever, and they actually apologized because they make far more money by not going, by not being found out and being publicized. They still wanted their $4.5 million. Apologized, but said we didn't mean to attack critical infrastructure.
That seems like a conundrum, right? I mean, you pay, but you get a, but you apologize. Well, I don't think it hurt to that extent. But yeah, did the CEO actually make a ransom payment to that, I think?
Yeah, and the FBI was able to claw some of it back. They must have had keys to their Bitcoin wallets or something like that. But, and I wasn't involved in the investigation, but it looked and smelled to me like they just did not have good security controls. And that's the job of a chief information security officer as opposed to a chief information officer or IT specialty. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have a security officer. And the CEO apparently figured the same thing out that I did, and they immediately launched a search for a chief information security officer. That security officer is going to find things and vulnerabilities and weaknesses that is not part of an IT team's normal day-to-day operations. Remember, IT is there to minimize help desk calls, to replace aging or damaged equipment or worn-out equipment. They're there to just make sure everything runs. You know, that investment in that whole IT department is about more profitability every single day. The security officer's job is to protect the overall viability, all the data of the company itself, to make sure that it doesn't get breached. It's a whole different mindset. That's why a lot of MSPs are struggling to make that transition. You really reverse it, flip it on its head.
But aren't the days of the CISO and the CIO getting kind of outnumbered now? It seems like the CIO, I never hear that acronym anymore. It's always the CISO. And the CISO now is kind of on a hot button all the time. So I'm going off on a different subject here, but it seems like now they're much more vCISOs than actually CISOs. But anyway,
when you're looking at the Fortune 500, absolutely. Now, they still have security officers that may not have a direct line of report to the CEO. You know, they may have to go through their chief technology officer. And that's not a good strategy either. You know, we're just now really seeing that flip around. But when you get into small to medium-sized businesses, the average business owner, CEO, or president of a $10 million company is not there yet. They're thinking in terms that this is an IT role. This is IT's responsibility to take this off my headache or take this off my list and make sure we're protected. But they haven't quite gotten into that mindset that they've got to think security first. You know, as of especially since the PC was invented, but even arguably before that, as a society, we've been trading productivity and efficiency and convenience for security, and now we're paying the price for it with all these tens of thousands of criminal hackers all around the world. You know, China has stolen so much intellectual property that many experts say it's the greatest transfer of wealth in human history.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you, and I haven't been to China, but I've watched several documentaries on how modern their cities are. I mean, in 30 years' time, 20 to 30 years, they've gone from practically, or actually, almost a third world country to where many of their largest cities are more advanced than any Western European city or United States city, any modern Western democracy city.
I've got a kind of like a Twitter friend or virtual friend. He went to Shanghai recently. My image of China was all pollution, you know, people walking the streets. And it's nothing like that. I mean, the pictures he took were bright sunlight. They're beautiful buildings. In fact, I'd say they're even more beautiful than the buildings I've seen in downtown Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's how far China has progressed in just about 20 years. And that's really not possible to do it without stealing a whole bunch of intellectual property.
Okay. Well, actually, one more question on this topic. How do you think this COVID-19 lockdown that they've tried to institute where there's zero cases, now we've seen how it's going to impact the economy, but, I mean, you're not going to have zero cases. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, are you talking about in China?
Yeah, China, yeah.
Well, it's my understanding, and I'm not an expert on human viruses, but it's my understanding that China doesn't have adequate vaccination. They don't have, it's not, they don't have the chemistry right. I think they've been refusing all of the stuff that the United States and other nations, Western democracies, has invented, you know, the Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer and whatever all the others are. You know, that was based upon decades of research, you know, DNA type or RNA type research has been going on for decades, and I don't think China had that. And their vaccines are less important, so that's really a different environment.
Okay. Well, that's a topic I'm going to talk about here just a little bit here in a few minutes. But anyway, let's segue into your book, The Cyber Pandemic Survival Guide. Tell us more about that. It seems very interesting, very intriguing.
Well, it's basically some of the world thinkers and you know, thought leaders are talking about and especially comparing computer viruses to human viruses. So Klaus Schwab heads up the World Economic Forum. You know, that's the Davos organization where everybody, all the rich and important people go to Davos, Switzerland every year. It's real expensive, hard to get into, and things like that. And Klaus Schwab was saying and is saying that imagine, you know, COVID-19 has taught us some valuable lessons. You know, COVID spread in around the globe in weeks and months, basically. Now, take everything we've learned about the COVID outbreak and what would happen if that was a computer virus outbreak. Well, that would spread in minutes and hours, days at the most, and it would make COVID feel like a speed bump, because if Russia, and we've got a model for this, although it wasn't an accidental deal, Russia conducted a full-scale cyber war on Ukraine 5 or 6 years ago, before this latest deal. Ukrainians did not know from one day to the next if the grocery stores were going to have food, if the planes, the buses, they could put gas in their car, if the electricity was on, gas was flowing. They didn't even know if Chernobyl was releasing radiation because those are computerized industrial control systems that control that. That was an all-out, unrelenting cyber war on Ukraine, and Russia stopped just short of killing people. It was getting the wintertime, and wintertime in Ukraine is pretty cold. Mm-hmm. And after a few months, I think it was 2 or 3 months of unrelenting attack, they loosened up. And Russia was able to do that because they harbor so many criminal hackers in the country. So I call them cyber mercenaries. Mm. And they just unleash them. They said attack at will. Okay? And they just brought Ukraine down to its knees. I mean, we saw a little taste of that with the Colonial Pipeline. Imagine if Russia opened up a cyber war on the United States and well, just say all the NATO countries. They could, you know, stop petroleum distribution and food supplies all over the country and all over Europe, because they have that kind of, they've got the skills and they've got the talent in order to do it. There's no Geneva Convention for cyber warfare. But the bigger thing that Klaus Schwab was really talking about are these highly advanced computer viruses that are typically developed by nation states, you know, like our NSA. You know, we've got cyber weapons, advanced cyber weapons, like the Stuxnet virus. The United States and Israel and maybe some other countries, you know, we took down, or the NSA took down, the nuclear enrichment facility in Iran with the Stuxnet virus. It got its way, they got it into the building, which was not connected to the internet, it was air-gapped. They got it into the building, and they very carefully designed it to where it would only execute in that particular environment, because they knew how dangerous it would be if it got out into the wild.
Right.
It would only execute a certain number of computers, certain number of centrifuges, and on and on and on. And then the NSA was breached, and their cyber warfare tools are now available to download off the dark web, including the Stuxnet virus and including the source code to all those viruses. So there really just hasn't been an organized or accidental full-scale release of a cyber pandemic virus yet. But many of us believe it's likely going to happen at some point.
Oh, I mean, it's inevitable. I mean, with what we've been seeing, and what my biggest fear and what I've been kind of blogging about from time to time is, you know, it's not just going to be like an attack on one critical infrastructure. It's going to be multiple attacks on multiple cities, on multiple critical infrastructures all at once, really kind of destroying our nation. That's what the most fearful thing is, I think.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a lot of people think that the Russian attack on Ukraine was just a test run. You know, they proved that cyber warfare is viable. It's just another type of war: Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, cyber, space. It's just another military division when you're talking about that. But it's not just the critical infrastructure. I mean, if you're going all out war like the Russians are doing in Ukraine right now, it doesn't matter if it's a hospital or an army base. They're attacking. So, you know, to think that just because you're a 10-person law firm that you won't get sucked up into that is not right. Because the Russians know that all they've got to do is tell their cyber criminals, hey, attack at will, collect whatever money you want to, and it's going to create chaos and tie up law enforcement and impact the society negatively and on and on and on, just like traditional kinetic weapons.
Okay. Wow, I got to read this book. I'm going to go ahead and buy it here soon, Tom. You got me. Got me intrigued. So, well,
yeah,
do you have any?
So what I'd like to mention to your listeners that when I wrote this book, I wanted to be sure it wasn't a dry, boring, you know, technical cybersecurity book. There's a fictional story that it's all wrapped up around about a small town in the United States where they have a really big attack on that town's government. And some people got hurt, and there's some interesting parts to it where it goes into these, we call them gray hat hackers. They kind of got, they've got a toe in, you know, both the bad guys and the good guys. They're gray hat hackers. So it's an entertaining read. It's an easy read. But at the end of it, you're going to know exactly what you need to put in. Protect you, your company, your family, and hopefully all of us. Because if everyone put in EDRs in their businesses and even in their homes, the threat of ransomware or any full-scale attack is going to be greatly diminished, or even a small attack. A ransomware would go away completely.
Yeah, in fact, I think I was reading a preview, actually, of your book in Amazon's last night. I remember that story. It got me pretty well wrapped up into it. So I'm going to buy that book. Anyway, what was it?
No, I was going great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, do you have any other books planned for the future? I think in one of our previous conversations, I think you had mentioned something coming out next year maybe, or can you confirm that?
Well, I do have one coming out next year, and it's more generalized management and leadership, because that's one of the, you know, I keep saying that cybersecurity is a leadership decision and IT management is a management decision. So, you know, I've been around, I've worked with small businesses all my life, and I've been exposed to those concepts. So I'm going to do a book about that that's going to be out sometime next year. But this fall, in November, I'm publishing a book about protecting high net worth individuals, you know, that C-suite of executives, you know, VIPs, others that, you know, a lot of companies forget about. The, you know, the CEO goes home to a family, and that's a threat vector. That whole, his whole personal electronic life is a threat to the company. Politicians, you know, professional athletes, you can just go down the list, and, you know, and they have a different risk profile than the company itself does, but yet they're still a threat vector.
Now, are you going to be talking about, you know, open source intelligence in this book? Because I know there are a lot of firms out there that specialize in OSINTs, and that's a whole different realm of cyber that they use to help protect, you know, these high net worth individuals.
Now, what did you call it?
It's OSINT, open source intelligence.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that, but to me it's really more of the common threats and the awareness that you've got to secure your life. You know, it's really my job is to paint the possibilities, and these are real possibilities. Some people are a victim of a cyber attack, and they you know, a ransomware attack, and they still don't do anything to make sure it doesn't happen again. We've got clients that didn't pick up the phone and reach out to us until they'd had their second or even third attack. So, you know, when you start getting into the weeds and where all the, you know, all this threat intelligence is coming from and what are the vectors and what's the storyline and all these technical things about cybersecurity, over 90% of breaches are caused by a human failure. That's the threat vector, is humans. They're conned, manipulated into allowing the bad guys to get in. Now, we still want to put the technical controls on there because we're going to do We practice a defense in depth, and anyone that's been in the military knows what I'm talking about. We don't want to be like the French in World War or before World War II and throw all of our money into the Maginot Line. That did not work against Blitzkrieg. That was, and they had not upgraded many, many other elements of their armies and navies and so forth, and that's all they had. The guns wouldn't even turn around backwards, and Blitzkrieg just ran over it. No more trench warfare. We're talking high-speed, kinetic military engagements. So we want to practice a defense in depth and wrap layer after layer after layer around the assets that we're trying to protect, because we're going to assume one or more layers is going to be penetrated. The human layer, we have to assume that's going to be penetrated. No matter if you implement security awareness training, that can still be duped. I know, because we simulate, we test ourselves, and a lot of our clients test themselves. And there's no one in the company except for one person that scored 100% on these simulated phishing emails. And I'm not him. I fell for one. Anybody can fall for these emails and other con jobs that are happening.
I have, too. There have been a couple times where actually I did it from PayPal. There are a couple of emails I got, and I checked for everything, but they knew how to put that sense of fear and urgency, and I clicked on the darling and going, oh, God, what did I just do? So I just changed my password immediately. And then he started
I got fooled once, and I just coincidentally was tweaking some of my Google privacy and security settings, and the phishing email came in from Google, and I used the link. Thing I know, I'm getting a 2-minute video on training me on what I did wrong. So they can fool con artists can fool anybody, giving the right environment, the right techniques, the right tools and procedures. They can fool anyone. Most people are not that paranoid to prevent that from happening. You've got to live your life. You can't be paranoid about every little thing. So there's always an opening there to be a victim of a con job.
In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I was prospecting, and I went to this one vendor's website, and all of a sudden it said, your computer is infected with malware. Do not shut down your computer. Call Microsoft immediately. And I'm going, it's a scam. So I just shut down the browser, reboot, and did a couple of malware scans. Everything was fine. But, yeah, it's just social engineering is really, I think, going to start to take root here pretty soon, too. It already has, but it's going to be one of the more, I think, commonly used threats as well, too. But, anyway, I kind of want to get your feedback on or your thoughts on some of the other issues in cyber, if you don't mind. The first one is the Internet of Things. Now, this is, where everything's connected together, the virtual world, real world, blah, blah, blah. This scares me because I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy. I still drive an analog Honda Civic 03. I don't have a smart car. I don't have a smart home or anything like that. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you have, a smart car or anything smart-related or...
I've got both old school and new school vehicles, but it's like this is happening, whether it's your automobile, your refrigerator, your home thermostat. These things all have chips in them, and for whatever reason, everything's going to be more and more connected. It's inevitable. That's the way the whole human society is moving towards, and it's made society so much better. More research and everything like that. The internet has opened up an entire wealth of human knowledge. Incidentally, the World Wide Web was created at CERN in Switzerland for the express purpose of sharing research from the Super Collider. That's located there. The internet was the United States, but the World Wide Web Hypertext Markup Language, HTML, that was actually invented in just by Tim Berners-Lee. And the purpose was is he wanted a place where he could share all the research that they're doing on these subatomic particles, you know, these nuclear and theoretical physicists that are studying all these years. But getting back to these connected up things, the United States, especially the United States, is the most vulnerable nation on the planet because we're also the most connected and most automated nation on the planet. Now, when you're looking at these Internet of Things, and I want to make a blanket statement here, they generally are more prone to be hacked. There was a casino in Vegas 2 or 3 years ago that lost a couple of $1 million because the hacker was able to access their network through a fish tank thermometer or thermostat. Now, so if you think about some of those casinos have these huge aquariums all over the complex. So they're applying technology to make sure the fish are healthy and clean and on and on and on. So they connected up to their network. Thermometer or thermostat had a vulnerability in it, and that allowed the hackers to get into the network. So there is no doubt that we have to not only be aware of these devices, but we've got to treat them and protect them just like we would a laptop, a smartphone, a desktop, and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. There's nothing special about an industrial control system, and that's really what we're talking about. A Nest thermostat, that's an industrial control system. You know, it's in your home, but it's an Internet of Things, and those can be hacked, and they might be accessed. So you've got to have your entire perimeter of your whole, your physical presence and your physical footprint has to be protected against these threats.
Okay, the next issue I want to talk about is artificial intelligence. Now, I think we've come a long way with AI, but there's still a much, much longer way to go until we can mimic the human brain. In fact, I don't think we ever will be able to mimic the human brain. But to me, AI, especially when it comes to cybersecurity, it's a much overly abused term. I think it's techno jargon for the vendors to kind of get prospects excited about their products. So they say, oh, I've got AI in my my security tools here. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. And the best EDRs use a neural net. I kind of like to use the term neural net or machine learning because AI means different things to different people. And I don't think any of it's sentient. And so that takes that part out there. But the cool thing about machine learning and a neural net is adapt and respond to brand new threats within minutes worldwide. So, for example, I know that if a brand new technical threat is detected by the same stuff that we use, you know, that has, you know, a neural net, is detected in Tokyo, that they already know the storyline to look for. And every single agent around the globe can now knows exactly what to look for so they can stop the attack. So it's got you can't do that with a traditional, you know, signature file-based antivirus product. Just can't do it. You're lucky if a vendor even gets you a new detection within a few days when a new threat is discovered in the wild. Some of them don't do well. It's kind of weird how that business works, but different vendors do it at different rates because of technical limitations in the product or whatever it may be. But the signature file, every single thing running on the computer is looking for that signature of a virus, that strip, that ones and zeros that says, oh yeah, this is that Trojan, and let's stop it. When you're using an EDR that has a neural net behind it, it's not necessarily looking for that, although it can see it. What it's looking for is what is happening that in the, that is likely to be something bad. You know, it's looking for anomalies, and it predicts what's going to come up because of the processes that are flowing. So if you look at the storyline of a phishing email ransomware attack, it sees the user opening up Outlook, opening up the email, then opening up the Excel spreadsheet, and then it sees the macro calling the Windows encryption service. It already knew two or three steps earlier that this might be an imminent attack. And then once it attempts to call the encryption service, it's intercepted and frozen. And security teams are alerted for further research. So it's a really good thing. I don't know that without neural nets that we would be nearly as effective in defending against some of these attacks that are out there.
For sure. The next one is, and we've alluded to this with China, is the remote workforce in COVID. Now, back in 2019, you know, COVID was starting to come on the news. It was localized to Wuhan province in China. I don't think anybody realized how it was going to change the world forever like it has. Obviously, a lot of bad things have come of it, but there's some good things that have come of it. Like, you know, we've been able to create vaccines in a very quick amount of time. The remote workforce is not the reality. It was thought it was going to happen in 4 or 5 years. What are your thoughts on all this? Like, how were you impacted? How are your clients impacted? And I'm not afraid to even say this. I think the COVID-19 virus actually came from that research lab. In my opinion, I think it was just a lab experiment that went bad. The protocols weren't put in place, and it just spread like wildfire. That's just my opinion, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know if it came from a wet market or a lab. That's a little outside. I'm not a virologist or medical doctor of any type. That's kind of outside my expertise. Now, if you take that theory and apply it to cyber pandemic, absolutely possible, maybe even likely that it came out of a lab. So far, computer code doesn't really evolve, although I guess an argument could be made that artificial intelligence might do that. But we haven't really seen AI applied, as far as I know, in any major hacking attempts. The bad guys, it's not bad. We don't have to worry about them having it. But I get your point. I could certainly, you know, looking at it from a cybersecurity standpoint, absolutely, I could see that. And other nation states, offensive cyber weapons are available to download off the dark web. So,
well, do you think the remote workforce is going to be with us permanently now? I mean, given now, obviously, in the beginning, when it first happened, you know, everything was done in a haphazard fashion. You know, companies didn't have their BC plans, DR or IR plans in place. So everything was just done hastily. But now it seems like companies now have come to some even keel now on how to protect their digital assets remotely. Do you think the remote workforce is going to now be the norm of American society, or will go back to being in the office full time? What are your thoughts on that, too?
I think it's just going to be a blend. I think it opened up a lot of people's eyes that, oh yeah, well, this particular role in the company and these particular people may work better from home. And so it's been, you know, in about a 2-week period in March of 2020, we literally configured hundreds of remote connections for people, because there was one week in there where all of a sudden everybody's working from home, and we got attorneys and accountants and on and on and on. They had to work from the house, got to log into the corporate network. And so we had to set up not only the access, but we had to protect it with multi-factor authentication and maybe a virtual private network. But, you know, what it's done is, you know, you see some companies that, hey, we worked on it, and we're doing it both ways. We're making it work. And I just think that's up to the culture and the leadership and everything of certain companies. Now, if you got a big manufacturing plant, you know, assembly line workers can't work from home. You know, they're required to be in the office, but maybe the marketing people can work from home. I don't have a hang up one way or the other. The only hang up that I've got is make sure you don't, when you're the leader of the company and you say, okay, well, if people can work from home, and just let them bring whatever the device, you know, their home computer to log into the company network. You've got to think about your corporate security, because that home computer becomes a threat vector. And so, in that March of 2020, we saw a 1,000% increase in attacks on remote connection technology. You know, your public IP addresses are scanned hundreds of times a second for vulnerabilities. This is part of that automated hacking world. They write these bots, they see a device light up on the internet, and they're immediately scanning for what's the operating system, what's the service, what's behind this IP address. And then it logs all the software services that it can see, and then they cross-reference that to the known vulnerabilities, and they start doing their hacking. And we could see it, you know, for those of you that knows a little bit about IT, you know, it's a remote desktop protocol, is the Microsoft remote connection technology, but they were doing log me in and all these others too, go to my PC. But just in 1 week, 1,000% increases on that technology. So, I just think you've got to think about how far. That's why we're talking to the C-suite in their personal lives. You know, we've got financial advisors that all of their clients might be high net worth individuals. And, you know, if your net worth is $10 million or $100 million or whatever, you might be the millionaire next door, but you've definitely got assets that you've got to protect. It doesn't matter if you work remotely or in your home or whatever. Those are just IP addresses and devices to the criminals and the other threat actors. They're just an IP address device. If their specialty is not hacking a Nest thermostat or a Nest thermostat, you better believe there's some criminal specialists that know exactly what to do to a Nest thermostat to get into the rest of the network.
Right. Okay. Excellent. Now, another hot button topic we're going to be seeing this year, in fact, it was before, is data privacy, the data leakage. The Amazon Web Services has been notorious for S3 data leakage that happens with their buckets. And now we've got these laws like the GDPR, CCPA, CMMC, and blah, blah, blah. They're really now ratcheting down on these higher volume companies in terms of revenue and employees. Have you had clients ask you about data privacy and have you helped them come into compliance with controls and so forth, or how have you approached that situation?
Yeah, not nearly enough. You know, if you go to the big data brokers, you can triangulate data, and you might not be able to personally identify an individual, but you can probably figure out where they live, and they can get targeted that way. The best rule of thumb, and probably the biggest problem I see out there, is using all of these services to where the user of the service is the product. You know, and I'm talking about Facebook, I'm talking about, Twitter, LinkedIn, the free Gmail service, and then theoretically the whole Android world, you know, those smartphones. And I just think that there's certainly a lack of awareness, but that information, privacy goes hand in hand with security. Everyone has information that needs and should be kept private. Everyone. Don't think just because your emails are boring and you're talking about a football game every weekend with your buddies that you don't have private information. First of all, you've got a username and password to get on that email. You've probably got a username and password for online banking, and the list goes on and on and on. So at the very minimum, that information needs to be kept private.
Now, here's
and if you use the services, you know, I've seen people get fooled on – how many times have you had somebody on Facebook that says, oh, don't – ignore everything from me, my account was hacked?
I get it all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, most people don't realize you can go into Facebook and not only turn off the ad tracking and all of the creepy things that they do, but you can turn on multi-factor authentication. And you should use a stronger password and don't reuse passwords. But privacy, you know, if I had to say there was a differentiating thing, you know, most companies know that their information's private, right? That's not something that requires any vision. Managers know that, you know, if they don't know if it needs to be private, it's private, right? From a company perspective, business perspective. But in your personal life, most people or many people have a tendency to think they don't have anything to hide, so they don't care if anybody's snooping around in their data, their information. And that creates a serious security risk. And it's at the very least, a manipulation of your beliefs and all sorts of things. Russians are marvelous at social engineering when it comes to Western democracies. They are absolutely good at it, and they're still good at it, and they're still doing it. That privacy thing is a real problem. They can watch what you're doing.
Okay, the last issue I kind of want to go over here with you is the cloud security. I'm sure this is probably near and dear to your heart, but you know, with COVID, remote workforce, companies are now going from on-prem to pretty much cloud infrastructure. What are your thoughts on that? What's the best way for people to secure their clouds? Just off the top of your head.
Well, it's really going to depend on the implementation, the architecture of both the inherent cloud provider itself, but also the architecture of the software that you're running on there. I get asked a lot, says, well, do you think AWS is secure? Yeah. Do you think Azure is secure? Yeah. Or whatever cloud service provider you're using? Yeah, I think they're secure. Our data center is probably the most secure in the world. The problem becomes when you start introducing the applications and the operating systems on these big public cloud providers, because every single thing you install has vulnerabilities. You know, web servers, VMware is going to be running Windows or maybe running some other operating system, and all of those things have to be patched. An InfoSec specialist will tell you that the cloud, just being in the cloud does not protect you. That the vulnerabilities are slightly different, but generally speaking, it could be compromised as easily as anything else. Especially when it comes to things like username and passwords and failure to use multi-factor authentication and all of that. But in reality, I've got friends that virtualize their entire office. Their desktops are all virtual. And the service provider told them that they didn't have to worry about security because it's all cloud-based. It doesn't get attacked. Guess what happened?
I got that.
Got hit with a ransomware attack across 40 or 50 of that company's clients in one fell swoop. Because they were, the IT providers were under the mistaken belief that you don't have to protect desktops if they're in the cloud. And all they would have had to have done is put EDRs on it, on every one of those endpoints. And it would never, that attack would never have happened. In my world, I make little distinction between, you know, I don't operate under the assumption that the cloud is more secure than on-premises. I think going to the cloud or not going to the cloud is more of a management decision, a finance decision, and on and on and on. But from a strategy and a leadership decision-making, I'm going to implement the best security in that environment, assuming that things are going to get breached, just like I would if it was inside my office or in my building.
Excellent. Now, back to your company, IronTech, what are your general plans for expansion? Are you going to try to kind of keep doing the same thing that you're doing, just get new clients, or do you want to expand more globally? As we're coming over this, you know, second half of the year and going next year.
Well, right now we're staffed to scale, and that's my immediate plans for the next couple of years. I would say, you know, we're growing at year over year 30% to 40%, depending on the month, and we're not happy with that. We want to increase that, and we've built the company to scale efficiently, and we're every single day we're doing more and more things to improve ourselves. You know, our company, we are our competition. We relentlessly review everything we do to see if it can be done better, both from a security standpoint, productivity, and efficiency. All of those things are important. And training, making sure our hiring practices, we're identifying and obtaining the right talent, and just growing. And I don't have any plans to go international, but if the opportunity comes up, you know, I think we've talked to a company in Australia, but there's plenty to keep us busy right here in this hemisphere for a long time.
Well, how big is your company, if I may ask?
There's 16 of us.
Okay.
Now, you've got to think that we've also got partner vendors that they staff the security operations center. We run a command center. So we're backed up by literally hundreds of InfoSec specialists all over the globe. And they have their little niche in what they work on. So if you remember the surgery office attack that I mentioned to you, that took our team, our security responders, and at least two other vendors, InfoSec specialists, to mitigate that threat. And we're backed up by it. So, you know, we've really got the ability to scale, and we continue to go that way. You know, we want to work with those specialists that know that EDR in and out and know exactly what its capabilities and limitations are.
Thank you.
So we can do things and remain a small company.
Okay, cool. Now, as we wrap up the show here in the last 10 minutes, what do you think the biggest cyber threat will be going into 2023? And what do you recommend for people to mitigate the risk of becoming a victim? We all can become a victim, but what can they do to mitigate that from happening?
Well, you need to engage with a security specialist. What I'm seeing as far as trends, we're seeing a big uptick in business email compromises, but that story I told you about the attorney and the criminal changing their bank account and routing numbers. We're seeing more and more website compromises. And those, one way they can manifest is that pop-up that says your computer's infected, call this 800 number, it looks like it's Microsoft, blah, blah, blah. That's because that website itself was compromised. I don't see enough, too many people don't spend enough money on website hosting to make sure that doesn't happen. So we're seeing a big uptick in that. But having said all that, going into 2023, ransomware is still a scourge. It's going to be with us for the foreseeable future, I'm afraid. And that's the biggest threat that we know everyone is vulnerable to. Home users and everything. Just imagine in your home you spent years collecting photographs and digitizing them, and all of a sudden your hard drive gets encrypted because of a ransomware attack. And that happens. And I believe that we're going to start seeing more and more attacks on, you know, not just famous people, not just billionaires, but I'm really talking about the millionaire next door. You know, the people that have enough either value or enough net worth from a financial standpoint or a publicity standpoint. I think that we're going to see a big uptick in that. I don't think the criminals have fully ramped up to go after these types of individuals. You know, there's about 30 million millionaires in the United States alone. You know, they have a net worth of $1 million or more. And I think we're going to start seeing more attacks on these types of people.
Okay. Now, finally, as we wrap up our show, Tom, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you if they want to learn more about your services or they feel they're a victim of a cyber attack that's going on right now? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, just go to irontechsecurity.com. There's all kinds of ways to contact us there, set our appointments up, call us, email us, you know, sales or command center at irontechsecurity.com. My website is tomkirkham.com. That's geared more around if you need keynote speaker or other things. We're going to develop that out more. I'm doing a speaking engagement next week in Atlanta. I don't think it's a keynote, but yeah, thanks. It's not many of those going around these days. I love speaking in public, but I think this will only be the second one since COVID started. So, I did another one. It's only been three or four in the last, you know, since COVID began. But that is for an accounting conference that's, I think it's five states involved with it. It's coming into Atlanta. But, if you're interested in, educational stuff for your company or maybe a society or an association that you're a member of to present to the members, either one of those will get you in touch with the right people to get that set up or to find out more about it.
Okay. Excellent. Well,
while I'm thinking about it, we have tons and tons of YouTube videos, both that we've done as well as vendor-provided educational material, e-books, PDFs, infographics, and just scads of videos, video material on some of the very things that we've talked about today. And you can find all of those on Iron Tech Security.
Okay. Excellent. Well, Tom, thank you for your time this morning, going into the early afternoon. It's certainly been enlightening, and we hope to have you on a future podcast again.
Oh, I would like that very much. It would be my honor.
It would be our honor too, sir. Thank you so much for your time.
All righty. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.